Good morning. I think we'll get started. My name is Jen Cates. I'm from the Kaiser Family Foundation, and I'm very pleased to welcome you all here today to the Foundation and our Barbara Jordan Conference Center. For a briefing, we are co-sponsoring with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a key partner of the Foundation on global HIV/AIDS issues. And today's briefing is really what we thought when we wanted to go to the implementers meeting and we didn't go is it would be great to have a forum to discuss this really important and unique meeting with those of us in D.C. Some of you went. I would guess most of us have not been there. And wanting to bring back the information from that unique meeting to a D.C. forum, given all of the context that we're here in the midst of on global HIV/AIDS policy. So the purpose of today really is just to provide a forum to discuss the meeting. And the implementers meeting is a special meeting, I think, and you'll hear more about it as the morning progresses. First, it's an implementers meeting. Unlike many of the other conferences and meetings we attend, the International AIDS Conference, many others, this is really a meeting focused on implementers, those in the field who are really struggling to make programs happen. It's not a meeting that's designed for those of us in D.C. trying to think about policy. Of course, the lessons are integral, but it's really for the people on the front lines, the people that we all want to hear from most of the time, but they're busy doing programs. So it's a meeting for them. It's organized by many different co-sponsors. I think some people always think it's a PEPFAR meeting. It's not a PEPFAR meeting. PEPFAR is one of the organizers, UNAIDS, UNICEF, World Bank, WHO, Global Fund, GMP+, and the host government, in this case, the Ugandan government. All of those entities work together to have this meeting. And I think the other thing about this meeting that's a little different, definitely different than the International AIDS Conference, is that it's small. It's about 2,000 or less people versus 25,000 people. So it's really a smaller group. I would venture to guess I didn't get to go this year discussing real issues right there and then. So hopefully we'll get some of those out. So this is how we're going to proceed today with the program. The Foundation was the webcaster of this meeting, and so we webcast all of the plenaries and other sessions. Those are available on our website for anyone who wants to watch them at any time, read the transcripts. Please do that. We encourage you to do that. But for today, we put together a short video clip of some highlights to just give you a sense of what the what the issues were or that came up and what the flavor of the meeting was. And I think you might notice if you've been to the International AIDS Conference or you've seen other clips from there, it's a different feeling kind of meeting. It's not a big, huge meeting, so it's much smaller in scope and focus. Then after the video, I'm going to turn to Steve Morrison from CSIS, who we work together to bring the forum together and work on many different global HIV/AIDS issues together. And Steve will provide some remarks and then introduce Ambassador Dybul. And we're very pleased that Ambassador Dybul took time today to come here and provide his perspective on this meeting. He will have to leave relatively quickly. So Carolyn Ryan, the Director of Program Services from OGAC, is going to stay with us and will represent them as well. We also will then have a brief moderated discussion with two people from my office and one from Steve's, who went to the meeting and will provide some of their perspective. But the main goal and the main thing we wanted to do was just open it up and hear from you, get some questions out there, and try to find out what we can about this important meeting. And I think we'll hear from Caroline that more of the information from the meeting will be made available in the next couple of months. So a lot of it will be available to us. So let's turn to the video. It's short, about 5 minutes.
It is now my pleasure and singular honor to declare the 2008 HIV/AIDS Global Implementers Meeting officially open.
The Implementers Meeting is a unique opportunity. It's a unique meeting in the world of AIDS where we have so many meetings, some more interesting than others. And it's a unique opportunity to talk about the on-the-ground realities of responding to AIDS with the people who are on the front lines and who are the closest to them, you.
Scaling up through partnerships, the theme of this conference, clearly summarizes the key strategy needed for implementation of AIDS programs, and that is working together.
I think that we can take mixed pride and sadness over progress. We have a picture on the one hand of significant and important life-saving progress in the expansion of programs around antiretroviral therapy and PMTCT. Substantial progress, but variable progress across countries. On the prevention agenda, however, in the challenge of preventing new infections, the progress is perhaps much less and disappointingly less than what we had hoped for or perhaps what we had expected.
And so it is appropriate that we are here in Uganda, the birthplace of effective preventive approaches to change social and sexual norms, to push to the next level and ensure that we begin the generational approaches that will lead to an HIV-free generation.
For the next 4 days, important deliberations will center around identifying critical barriers and sharing information that will directly impact HIV/AIDS program implementation in the coming years.
Knowing your epidemic and knowing your response.
Men having sex with men. Unsafe injecting drug use.
Women and girls.
Commercial sex workers.
Orphan and vulnerable children.
And our quest to know our epidemics must begin with the simple assertion that there is no such thing as the global AIDS epidemic, but rather a multitude of diverse epidemics. No single set of prescriptions can be valid in, for example, Uganda, the Ukraine, Papua New Guinea, or elsewhere.
Positive prevention, male circumcision,
partner reduction.
Prevention of mother-to-child transmission.
Provider-initiated HIV counseling and testing.
Discrimination and stigmatization.
And the most poignant example of that, you know, took place here over the last couple of days when three gay activists from Uganda, you know, tried to come into this room to demand health care, to engage in health care, and were arrested for it.
Linking resources to people.
What resources are we talking about? What people are we linking to the resources? And at what level are we linking these people to resources? And what are the strengths of the linkages?
Integrating services.
The word integration slides very easily off the tongue. And I think it's a complex word, and I think we have to be cautious as to what we mean by integration and to reflect and think about where we want to truly integrate and where we want to really battle the tough work that's involved in establishing effective linkages.
Human capacity development.
One of the more novel approaches to human capacity development has appeared in recent times in terms of GIPA in action, greater involvement of people living with HIV and AIDS.
Monitoring and evaluation.
M&E and surveillance is not just an add-on, but is part of our response to managing the epidemic at national and right down to community level.
Harmonization and coordination.
Harmonization, alignment, coordination. It is not a new issue. We have been talking about it for years. But it is central to the long-term response.
Let us carry these new ideas, the new insights, and the renewed determination to sustain our efforts. And in the light of improved understanding of the epidemics in each of our countries, knowing the epidemic, as the rapporteurs have said, what works and what doesn't, make careful and evidence-based choices, particularly in the area of prevention.
We are at the start of a new phase in the fight against AIDS. And we are entering this new phase because we have results. And with the results come a new generation of challenges.
As we step forward to meet the challenges before us, let's do so with even more enthusiasm and hope. Let's rededicate ourselves to save and improve more lives. Above all, let's dare to keep dreaming, because the greatest lesson we have learned these past 5 years is that dreams come true.
And also I'll just say that Alicia Carbo on my team actually has hidden producer talent because she put that together with our tech team. So now I'm going to turn the podium over to Steve Morrison, who's the director of the CSIS Africa Program and the CSIS Task Force on HIV/AIDS, and as I mentioned earlier, a collaborator and partner of the foundation on many global HIV issues, and we've been putting together these forums for quite a while. So, Steve, thanks again, and thanks to CSIS for doing this today.
Thanks. Welcome and good morning. And thanks to Janet and Alicia and Jen for helping put all of this together, as well as Kate Hoffler from CSIS. 2 points of just quick advertisement before we talk a bit about this program and introduce Mark Dybul. On the 15th of July, we will be having a program that will be of interest to many of you up in the Senate in Russell 385. It will run from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., and the point of this gathering, it's really marks a very important point in the task force, the CSIS task force that's been ongoing now for 7 years. We're bringing together a series of speakers from the Senate and key experts to talk about really three subjects. One is to reflect on the massive changes in international engagement, including U.S. engagement on global public health in the last decade, particularly in the last 7 or 8 years, as to what drove that process and what were the major lessons and challenges emerging from that experience. The second issue that will be a central subject is the vision looking forward, how to bring about much greater coherence and in the U.S. approach and that of others in the coming future. And the third major subject is looking at what technological and behavioral changes might be on the horizon that may shape the environment of this next phase. We'll hear the speakers will include John Hamry from CSIS, Senators Feingold, Brownback, John Kerry, and Sherrod Brown, among others, who will join us, Ambassador Dybul, Elaine Gale, and Anthony Fauci. We'll be sending notices out for that meeting later today, and please join all of us. It's in Russell Senate Office Building, Room 385, at 9 a.m. on the 15th. On the 25th of June, we'll be teaming up again with Kaiser Family Foundation, this time over at CSIS, to review the outcomes of the health outcomes, global health outcomes of the G8 summit in Hokkaido, Japan. That begins at 10 a.m. At CSIS and B1 Conference Center. We will have Dr. Takimi from the Japanese global health team coming from Boston to open that. We'll have a representative of the U.S. team and experts. We're hoping Mike Green from CSIS will be with us. Now, back to the subject here at hand, the implementers meeting. Just a couple of comments. I mean, this really reflects the emerging power and voice and significance of the implementers who are on the ground in the countries, in the focal countries and beyond, and the fact that their knowledge and their experience is becoming so vital to thinking about the future and adjustments in approaches and what lessons are emerging and what new approaches are required. And I think it's really commendable that the U.S. and others have institutionalized this and been so successful at moving this forward. And what we're really looking for today is to distill out some of the most distinctive opinions and the mood and lessons that came through these discussions. I know that's very hard to distill, but I think we've got a number of people here who were present, who are close observers and astute observers of these sessions. I think it's also really impressive as to how much this has become a truly multilateral event, which is terribly important, and it sends a very powerful signal to our other partners in the world. So I'm very pleased that we're able to do this. I think your presence today shows how strong an interest it is here in town in hearing what the outcomes are. We're very grateful to OGAC for extending invitations to both Janet Fleischman and Alicia Carbo to attend It's another sign of the kind of relationships that we've been able to build over the years, and we're very grateful for that. Now, Mark Dybul is going to open up and set the stage for us. Mark, Ambassador Mark Dybul is known to, I'm sure, to all of you. For the almost 2 years now, he's been the U.S. Global AIDS coordinator. For the 6 months prior to that, he was the acting coordinator, and for several years prior to that, was the acting coordinator. I think we're looking back on his tenure in the leadership of the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator and the launch of PEPFAR and all of the multiple facets of that program. We've been very fortunate to have him, very fortunate for the passion that he brings to this, for the openness, for the programmatic and technical knowledge that he brings, his willingness to engage, as we've seen here today, the longevity of his presence from the moment of the earliest moment of creation. He was on the initial planning team, which was a small team that put the basic parameters together. So we've asked him to come and sort of reflect on what he sees as the most important outcomes from this. We've also asked him to take a few questions at the conclusion. His time is limited. I would just ask all of you not to steer the discussion in the question and answer period onto the other subject at hand, which is the reauthorization process. Since we're not here really to talk about that, we're here to talk about the outcomes from the Kampala Implementers Conference. So please honor that request, and I think we'll get more Mark's time. He won't run out of the room. So with that, Mark, please come forward. Thank you so much.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks, Steve. And thanks very much to Jen and Steve for putting this on, and to Kaiser for doing the webcasting for the plenary sessions. And as Jen mentioned, and I'll talk about this in a minute, that all of the abstracts will be on the web, but I'll explain why they're not on yet in a moment. I thought what I would do, unfortunately at these meetings I get to spend less and less time in the sessions and more time at side meetings, which Caroline gets to go to all the meetings, so she'll talk through the science. But I thought it might be useful to talk a little bit about the evolution of the meeting and how we got to this meeting. It really begins with the theory that the small planning task force started with for PEPFAR. PEPFAR was designed, and as many of you recall, there was a lot of discussion about focus countries and why we have them. We were designed to support a number of countries for national scale-up. Those 15 countries happen to have half the disease in the world, but that we thought that by doing national scale-up, as opposed to spreading resources around 120 countries where we'd have lots of great pilot projects, but by doing national scale-up, supporting national scale-up, we would learn important lessons that could then be used throughout the world for national scale-up, that the time was passed for smaller regional provincial pilot projects. We needed national scale-up. So the purpose of this meeting was to share those lessons, what was being learned as national scale-up was beginning. But we went through an evolution, as we've done in many things in PEPFAR, learning as we go. The first meeting was a very small meeting. It was 100 people. It was U.S. government only. We realized pretty quickly after that meeting that that wasn't a very good way to share lessons learned and have discussions. And so we moved, I have to be honest, with a lot of resistance internally to inviting our own partners, PEPFAR partners from the countries, to scale and to have a meeting. That was about 450 people in Addis. Well, pretty quickly after that meeting, which was a pretty big success, it was clear to us that we were missing a lot. First of all, we were supposed to be learning things to share with others. That was part of the vision for PEPFAR. But also, there were a lot of other lessons being learned that we needed to learn from the Global Fund, from country programs themselves, from many other World Bank and other programs that were scaling up. So we needed to evolve even further. And that led to the first co-sponsored meeting, because we thought it couldn't just be a U.S. government meeting. It needed to be a co-sponsored meeting. It was kind of a twist the first time in South Africa, because to have an international meeting, you have to go through a lot of approval processes in South Africa. So that was still technically a PEPFAR meeting. But it was with the full co-sponsor list of UNAIDS with all of its co-sponsors, the Global Fund, and then UNICEF, World Bank, and World Health Organization as well. The next meeting was the first true international meeting when we could even call ourselves all co-sponsors in Rwanda. And there we realized that among all the co-sponsors, we were missing an important voice, which is civil society. And so GNP Plus was added, unfortunately, late as a senior advisor, but this year they were a full co-sponsor. And we thought that was important to have a civil society co-sponsor organization. And so Kevin Moody was there and fully integrated into the program this year was the voice of civil society. And I'll talk about that in a minute. So that's where we got to this meeting. And as Steve pointed out, I think it really was a good evolution. It should be a meeting that is co-sponsored from all the major implementers, and it should be a meeting where all implementers are together sharing lessons learned. So I think it's a great example of how we need to look to the future, which is be willing to change, be open to change, look to see where we can learn things and change and improve what we're doing. And that really is how this meeting has evolved. As both Jen and Steve pointed out, I think it has been a tremendous success, largely because of the co-sponsorship and largely because of the broader program itself. This year there were 1,600 implementers from 68 countries. I think the most exciting thing, and if you look back to even the South Africa meeting to this meeting, South Africa to Rwanda to this meeting, the thing that struck most of us is even in South Africa, a lot of the presenters were still from international organizations. A lot of them were still from co-sponsoring organizations or the kind of parent organizations, the international partners. Rwanda changed a little bit, but this past meeting, the vast majority of presenters were from the countries themselves. And this was the most exciting thing this time, the vast majority of questions and interaction was from people from the countries themselves. So we've seen that real evolution towards country-owned programs, and that, importantly, was from all sectors. One of the things we did this year was ensure that we had wide representation, and so we had 110 invited speakers, and that we had all aspects of implementation, government, non-government organizations, including faith, community-based organizations, the private sector, and civil society groups, including people living with HIV/AIDS. And so we had panels after every plenary session made up of a representative from all of those sections. So I think we've really had a tremendous evolution. It was also very successful in terms of the abstracts that were presented. We had 1,600 abstracts submitted, which is, again, by far the highest we've had. 391 were accepted for oral presentations and 144 for poster presentations. I think one of the things that's clear is in any meeting, the quality of the presentations and abstracts was mixed. There were some very high quality, some still probably too much qualitative, but we've had an evolution in that as well. And one of the things we'll be working on is improving the quality of the presentations and programs. The other thing we've had struggled with and evolved over time with is interactiveness, trying to move from didactic presentations to interaction. And so we did a lot more breakout sessions this time. But even in those, unfortunately, as soon as you give people a microphone, they want to go on forever. So we have to figure out again how to get that balance of interaction. But I think what really was the key here and was who was presenting and who was asking questions, and that it's implementers. It's implementers. And a lot of the best work, as often happens in these meetings, is after presentations when people see something to get together in groups, and the stuff that was going on in the corridors and the side sessions and the spontaneous groups that got together to work through implementation issues was really exciting. And that's what we need to get more of for the next time. And our International Steering Committee is already working on how we can evolve again to ensure that we have more interaction and more implementer-to-implementer conversations. But it was a very exciting meeting. The flip side of that for many of you in the room is a lot of you don't get to come. A lot of you a lot of more policy types have in the past applied, and unfortunately this is not that meeting. And the one thing that sponsors, co-sponsors, and we have been clear on is this is not a competition or trying to compete with other meetings. This is really a niche. And I think the co-sponsors were very clear after this meeting that we have, in fact, found a niche that needed to be filled, which is for a place for implementers and only implementers to meet. We do policy and work in a lot of other meetings, but we've got to keep it as an implementers meeting. Michelle Kazakhstan somewhat jokingly said that in a couple of years we'll probably have an independent society of implementers that will run the meeting, and that's quite possible, but we hope not. We'd like to keep it kind of the way it's been going and the energy around it. But it was a very exciting meeting. We're looking forward to improvements for next year as well, focusing on that interaction, that sharing between implementers. So, again, thanks to Jen and Steve for the work that supported the meeting, especially Kaiser and the work they do. The abstracts, the reason we don't have the abstracts on the web now is because we have an agreement with the International Aid Society that when they have their meetings, which is actually every year, because we want a full sharing of information. We don't want people submitting abstracts to one or the other. We want people to share information. And so to assure that people aren't publicly disclosing data in advance of a meeting, because that's something that doesn't happen, we have an agreement with them that we will hold the public presentation of the abstracts until their meeting begins. So in the first week of August, all of the abstracts will go up, which allows us to ensure that all of the information can be shared. And that's a great agreement we've had with IAS going forward. We also work closely with IAS. They have a session at our meeting, and we have a session at their meeting, where we will present the rapporteur sessions and IAS, and they present some of the information about their meeting at ours. We didn't do a very good job picking a time for that this year. It was the last night, and so people were kind of tired of meetings, but next time we'll do it a little bit differently. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions about the meeting. As Steve said, there's something else going on in the city, reauthorization, but it'd be good to focus here on the meeting because I think that's what we're here to discuss, and there are other avenues and venues where we can talk about reauthorization.
Hi, I'm Heather Boonster from the Guttmacher Institute. And I did want to talk to you about one of the themes at the meeting around integration, because as I understand it, there wasn't a lot of discussion on gender or the importance of family planning providers in preventing HIV. And I wanted to ask you for a moment about the policy of the United States on this issue. And it's my understanding that, and I would like some clarity on the linkages between family planning and HIV, because it's my understanding that the country operational plan makes a pretty categorical statement that PEPFAR funds may not be used to support family planning activities.
This gets into the reauthorization issue, not the meeting. I'll ask Caroline to discuss the meeting and what occurred related to family planning, because I don't know. I'm not involved at all in the selection of abstracts or the creation of sessions. That's done by a multitude of groups between the different agencies that present information. So relative to the meeting, I actually don't know. I do know there were a lot of sessions related to gender and a lot of speakers related to gender. And I do know there were discussions of family planning because I saw some of the slide presentations from them. But I don't know. Unfortunately, I didn't get to participate in most of the meeting. But Caroline will go through, and I'm sure Janet will as well, what was discussed at the meeting about family planning.
Okay, so I can ask my question later then about the U.S. policy?
This is not to talk about policy. This is to talk about the implementers' meeting. Our policy has been the same since the beginning. It has not changed. We support linkages with family planning programs. We will continue to support linkages with family planning programs. Our policy has not changed in any way, shape, or form since the beginning of this initiative, but that's not what we're here to discuss. We're not here to talk about U.S. policy. We're here to talk about the meeting.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Maybe a couple questions? All right.
Can I
just
jump in?
Question. Sue Willard from the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation. From where you sit, what did you think was the most significant thing that came out of that meeting, besides just people really getting together?
I do think the most important thing in this meeting, in context of the other meetings, was the clear sense of ownership from the countries, from all aspects of the countries, and the notion of national scale-up as what we're aiming for. It really was moving past pilot projects, little projects. People are talking about, if you're doing prevention, if you're doing PMTCT, whatever you're doing, the next pilot project is a NIS national scale-up. And I thought that was incredibly exciting. We really have moved that conversation. The other thing is something that's been evolving over time, which is the clear focus on prevention, we have done very well in treatment. We've done fairly well in care, although I think in orphan care there was pretty good evidence that we have a long way to go. But a real recognition that we are trailing scientifically and in implementation in terms of prevention. And that, I think, but that's something that's been building from meeting to meeting of several different venues, but every speaker, every head of organization, as you saw, really emphasized that piece, the need to focus on prevention. But as a meeting itself, I think the most exciting thing was the true ownership by in-country people, and especially the questions. You know, you can get people to present, but when you've got most of the questions coming from the in-country people, it was very exciting, and that interaction. And the real sense that we need to be focusing on national scale-up, not smaller projects at this point.
Mark, was there any discussion of the impact of sort of worsening food insecurity in the environments where people are operating? Because it's become such a huge issue of late, and it has great implications for the sustainability of programs. And secondly, on the health... On the human capacity side, what was the sentiment that was coming forward with respect to creating effective health systems and staffing them adequately, training people?
Caroline will go through some of the, and I'm sure Alicia and Janet will go through some of the sessions themselves. On food, it was raised in a couple of the sessions about the increasing cost of food and therefore the trade-offs that need to occur in programs and the weakening dollar relative to that as well. So it was discussed. I would say it was more, from my understanding, it was more brought up in some of the care sessions and some of the OVC sessions, and a little bit in the treatment because we do a lot of therapeutic food programs as well. All of us together do therapeutic food programs as well. So it was brought up, but I don't think it was very extensively brought up, at least in my... It was raised by a couple of the plenary speakers and a couple of others, but I think it occurred more in the side sessions as implementers were talking to each other about the increased cost and how they're dealing with it and how they're ensuring continuing food supplies. But again, I'll leave it to the folks to discuss. Capacity development was one of the principal things that people focused on. And I think one of the more exciting things was how much is being done that people generally aren't recognizing. How much capacity building is part of every program that is being created. And this is one of the things I think we've been saying for a while, is that you don't get to national scale-up without building the systems that are necessary for national scale-up. I mean, you're going into countries that don't have supply systems, logistics systems, human resource systems, communication systems, and you have to build all that to have national scale-up. And that gets back to the principal point of national scale-up. And it was very exciting to hear the different approaches people are doing. In terms of the human resource in particular, most of the emphasis was on task shifting and a lot of follow-up from the new WHO report, which we were very much involved in and co-sponsored, and a lot of talk about how people are implementing task shifting, particularly around certification and credentialing and how effective it is. I think by the next meeting, we'd like to see a lot more data on the effectiveness of the task-shifting approaches. But it was clear that how much is being done that is not generally discussed in other fora. One of the exciting things, a lot of this was occurring in the civil society, non-governmental sector. Some of the more exciting, new, innovative approaches were coming from the programs that realize they just have to do it if they're going to implement it. And governments are starting to do it, but following a little bit further behind. I think the WHO and the discussion of that was so important because seal of approval, the governments will feel a lot more comfortable moving forward on that. But Ethiopia presented their approach, and a number of other countries did as well. So there was a lot of discussion on that. But it wasn't just human capacity. It was all the systems that are necessary. And that's really one of the exciting things that's happened, that there's not a lot of discussion about, I don't think, outside of this type of meeting, about how much has been done to build those systems, because there's no other way to get national scale up.
Do you, as a matter of course, try to systematically survey this population? Like, are you out there giving them some sort of questionnaires that target some of these key issues so that you come away with a greater set of data around how they're seeing things and what they're doing?
We do have surveys from them, but it's more on the meeting and what we can do to improve them. The purpose of the abstracts and the presentations is so that we have all that, so we know what's going on.
Right.
We have internally, within PEPFAR, as opposed to all the implementers, been doing surveys on human capacity and a couple of other things to find out what's going on. That's why we know now we're supporting over 100,000 health workers, their salaries in the focus countries. So we are starting to collect more ourselves, and monitoring and evaluation was a key thing that was discussed as well, and how we can do a better job collectively of garnering this information so that we have it for presentation. There was a lot of side discussion about that, how we can do a better job, especially among some of the more senior members, how we can do a better job collecting the information so we can tell the story in a better way. And there's been some follow-up since the implementers meeting on that with the AIDS ambassadors and the envoys. There was a session at the UN General Assembly about how we can do a better job collecting the information and sharing it.
I actually have a couple of quick questions, and I think we'll soon go to Caroline to review some of the main things that came up at the meeting. But one is just a preview of something we're about to release with UNAIDS in the next week, the latest data on donor government, G8, and others, funding for HIV. And I'm wondering if the issues around financing came up at the meeting. Are implementers, is that a still talking about that as a barrier, or is it really other barriers that they're really focused on? And the second is anything about the next meeting in terms of location and that you might want to preview.
There was a lot of discussion about long-term sustainable financing. I have to say the greatest expression from multiple speakers, whether they're in-country people, people living with HIV/AIDS, the international implementers, is in the importance of reauthorization, that there's a lot of anxiety in the countries. And annual appropriations just doesn't mean anything to the people in the field. There's a lot of anxiety, a lot of concern about scaling up programs in the absence of authorization, and that came out loud and clear from the implementers, that in the absence of a five-year umbrella commitment, where just tens of thousands of people are going to go without services and die. It's not that anyone's afraid we're going to back off the current ones, but people are going to be anxious about scaling up programs, and there's just no doubt about it, whether you talk to the government or non-governmental or any sectors. That's where most of the discussion was focused on financing, aside from the usual conversation that we always have about the need for long-term sustainable financing. For the next meeting, the International Steering Committee, which is made up of all the co-sponsors, is currently looking at that. Last year we were able to, there's a lot of desire to have it outside of Africa. The problem there is cost, because most of the implementers are still from Africa, and it's very expensive when you start looking at non-African places to send people. But there's a real limit to the number of places that can house 1,600 people and have a plenary room for 1,600 and then breakouts. So there's an effort now to, and a lot of places actually have built some of that capacity, so there's an effort now to look at that. Everyone's first instinct right now is to go outside of Africa, but as we're looking at the cost, I'm not sure we're going to be able to do that. But we should know in the next couple of months, because we have to lock in contracts and things.
One more question for Mark, and then we'll hear from Caroline. Take the microphone, please.
I'm Georgia Sambanaris from USAID. I was wondering, in your conversations with the implementers as well as the counterparts, did the meeting reveal the reaction to decentralization and the approach to HIV/AIDS, which would have implementers empowering local officials at the community level? In applying that to scaling up and sustainability, do you need to have fiscal resources at the community level? And rather than having the center of national governments promote scaling up, should it be done maybe from the bottom up? I'd like your views on that and your views on the reactions of the implementers as well as the counterparts.
Well, there's a lot of discussion of decentralization, especially around human resources, the Ethiopia example being a very good one, but that most of the decentralization, as you know, begins with national planning, which then leads to decentralization. But I think one of the more exciting things, and you know, in talking in response to Steve's question about human resources, a lot of the really exciting stuff is being done by the community non-governmental organizations. I mean, the majority of people who were presenting and discussing were from non-governmental organizations doing this creative work at the community level. And I think one of the more exciting things we've seen is pushing services down to the community level. And all of the implementing agencies, especially the Global Fund, is very focused on this with its CCMs and involving civil society and pushing to the community level. as in most things in development, it's not either or. You need both. You need both pushing from below. A lot of the creative, innovative ideas are coming down from the individual programs, but then you also need the national programs, both for national scale up and for overarching guidance and approaches. So I think that's very much a part of what was exciting about this meeting is you had all aspects learning from each other. I mean, I was actually in sessions where senior government people were hearing about innovative community programs and saying, wow, we need to do more of that. And that's one of the more exciting things. And that's where the side discussions really started, where national AIDS coordinators and vice ministers started bringing in people to communities on the side to say, how did you do that? How can we implement that kind of program in our country? It was that kind of give and take and learning from each other that I found most exciting. And again, it gets to the questions. When the questions were the most exciting because they were coming from all these people on the ground who clearly were implementing the programs and knew what they were doing, asking pointed and very insightful questions. So you probably need both center and community. And but what we found was that incredible excitement around the integration of these pieces. And again, the civil society engagement was critical. The vast majority of people at that meeting were not government. They were the community organizations and the grassroots organizations doing the work. And it was a very exciting thing.
Well, we promised Mark that we wouldn't keep him too long. So let's
thank you all very
join
much.
Me in thanking him for being here. Carolyn Ryan actually has a presentation. We were very fortunate that OGAC was able to bring this here because it hasn't been made available yet to show to people. And it will be some of the highlights from the meeting with the data and real substantive information. So thank you.
Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for letting me make this short presentation. I'm going to give a presentation which is really a snapshot of what was presented at the implementers meeting. It was a 3.5-day meeting, and I'm going to give sort of a summary of the rapporteur session, which was a 3-hour session. I promise not to do it in 3 hours. But I do feel a little bit like I'm trying to describe to you an ocean by showing you the water in the bathtub. So here were the themes of the meeting. Knowing your epidemic and response, human capacity development, linking people to resources, coordination and harmonization, integration of services, and monitoring and evaluation for impact improvement. And the structure of the meeting was as follows. For each of the theme, which were half days, there was a plenary session, usually with two speakers, followed by a moderated panel. And on the panel, there was a representative of the private sector, the NGO sector, the government, faith-based or community-based organization, and a person living with HIV. Then that was followed by 8 concurrent breakout sessions on this topic in 3 tracks, usually about 2 to 3 breakout sessions per track, care, treatment, and support, prevention, and cross-cutting and policy. So let me just briefly go through some of the issues that came up. And again, I'm really just skimming it. It's a little bit like a trailer at a movie theater. I'm hoping to whet your appetite so when they get on the website, you'll want to delve in further. So here were the topics that were presented. Adult treatment and care, pediatric treatment and care, counseling and testing, TB-HIV, food and nutrition, orphans and vulnerable children, and some key observations. I would say there were 3 main themes that people were focusing on. How do you get more people into treatment and care? How do you keep people in treatment and care? And how do you assure that there's quality of services? And let me just show you some data from Mozambique that was presented by Wafa El Sadr from Columbia University. And I want you to look at these are quarters for 2006. I want you to look at the beige and then the orange bars. And what's really important to note is over the year how they were able to get the number of people, women who were eligible for ART based on CD4 count onto antiretroviral therapy or HART. So you can see it went from very low levels of eligible women up to very high levels. So that's quite good. Now the government of Ethiopia, you heard Mark talk about Ethiopia, they looked at their retention and mortality during 6 months of antiretroviral therapy, and this is a real key, keeping people on antiretroviral drugs. And they found that after 6 months, 72% of the patients in a rural district were still on care, with 8% loss to follow-up. Now, what related to loss to follow-up? It was distance from facility, being a male, having advanced disease, and being older. So this is a very important, we heard one of our one of the questions, decentralization now becomes a very important piece of programming care, because we have to make sure that we deal with the distances to the facilities, and we also need to look at how do we diagnose people sooner. This is from Nigeria, a little concerning, because if we look at a Nigerian site, they had 27% of their people started on care lost to follow-up. How did they monitor this? Actually, they did it by looking at prescriptions in their pharmacy, and anyone who didn't get pick up 99% of their prescriptions was then followed up on. So there are some very, very creative, it was a session just on how do you deal with faith-based and community programs to deal with reducing patient default, and it was a really excellent session where they looked at getting trained ARV clients that become devoted community members, doing consistent home visits, peer educators for tracking the defaulters, and a very interesting program in Swaziland where they gave phone time on their cell phones to the people in their program and did follow-up mobile phone. Now, what about the quality of some of the care? This is from Kim Fox in Thailand, looking at putting in a quality assurance system. And over time, you can see from 2002 to 2005, the ability to make sure that their antiretroviral services were putting in place consistent CD4 testing, PCP prophylaxis, and TB screening. What about gender and HIV and the outcomes in antiretroviral therapy? A very interesting South African study looked at 6,500 people on antiretroviral therapy over 3 years. 66% were female. Women were younger, had higher CD4 counts, better BMI, and a lower WHO classification. And what was very interesting is to look at the difference in between males in blue and women in red between the survival or loss to follow-up. So you can see the women do better than the men. So what happens is women tend to have an increase in their cell count sooner. They tend to get viral load suppression sooner. Men seem to access treatment later. They're sicker. They have a worse immunologic and virologic reaction. So we need to start focusing on men. They now become a vulnerable group. And looking at things like workplace VCT, male-friendly clinics. There was one program that made antiretrovirals available to men at the post office. Pediatric care was also a big theme this year. And again, there was a whole session at how do we link PMTCT and MCH care and treatment services so it's one-stop shopping, especially for pregnant women. There was some interesting issues. In one study in Rwanda, they found that 53% of the deaths among children occurred in children under 36 months. It was seen that children respond well to antiretroviral therapy in Uganda in both rural and urban environments. The rural children were much sicker at presentation, but they responded well. And HIV-positive children who are not started on antiretroviral therapy early tend to get lost to follow-up. So rethinking the WHO classification for CD4 count and making CD4 count available to children is very important. And UNICEF has a programming framework that was mentioned many times and is available to healthy implementers and shared during the session. Now I want to look at HIV testing in TB clinics and the TB-HIV coordination. And this was a presentation presented from the recent WHO data by Kevin DeCock. And we are making strides. In 2002, we had only 7.5% of TB patients treated, now up to 35%, but still a long way to go. So what have we seen? There has been progress made, as we mentioned, but there still needs, we have to get a one-stop shopping approaches to TB and HIV services. There's efforts to decentralize HIV care and treatment to the primary health care level for both TB and HIV, and the provision of giving clotrimoxazole to TB patients. There was a lot of information about doing routine TB surveillance systems, including Homebase in Kenya, routine TB surveillance systems. And the international agencies have recently made efforts to harmonize reporting indicators, and that has been a positive thing. Now, I know that Stephen mentioned what was discussed on food and nutrition, and there was a session on food and nutrition. And it was stressed that there is an urgent need to strengthen nutritional support as a critical component to comprehensive care and treatment of HIV patients, as well as for women in PMTCT programs and for OVCs from birth to 18 years. There were many examples of where clinical services provided a platform for nutritional assessment, counseling, and support, but there was a lot of concern that the food crisis will increase the vulnerability of patients and their families and OVCs and their communities. There was interesting data presented about OVC programs. A multivariate analysis of DHS data from 11 countries showed that gender, region, wealth, rather than orphan status, affected school attendance. So the conclusion was that policies and programs should avoid just a single-minded focus on orphan status and target a composite of contextualized vulnerability factors. Now, what about prevention? This is a quote from President Museveni's introductory remarks. He said, "Prevention is the first choice for life." And these are some of the critical messages were Know Your Epidemic, coordination and harmonizing national programs, behavior change, including ABC, most at-risk populations, positive prevention, male circumcision, prevention of mother-to-child transmission, medical transmission. For Know Your Epidemics, there were several sessions, and they essentially, the take-home messages were, concentrated epidemics are preventable, but in the face of challenging environments, MSM and IDU programs have not been fully developed or gone to scale. And in generalized epidemics, countries have been slow to respond to the drivers, including lack of male circumcision and multiple concurrent partnerships. There was a session on multiple concurrent partnerships, and several issues were raised. There is a need for well-evaluated programs, models, and interventions. And there is some confusion as to what should be the right message. Have only one partner, reduce partners, don't overlap partners. There was an increased risk perception. There's a need to increase the risk perception around concurrent partnerships. And a very good example from Swaziland of the need to involve communities in constructing appropriate messages and to tailor the message to the type of partnership. In conclusion, it really was decided there needs to be a multi-level approach for social change from the society to the individual. I think this was one of the most popular sessions, at breakout sessions. It was standing room only at the male circumcision session. And when we look at programs presenting, Swaziland and Zambia have the most advanced programs, and really a lot of countries were very anxious to share their experience shared. They recommended only for HIV negatives. The complication rates were low for trained medical providers and higher for traditional providers. And there was a lot of discussion about how to integrate traditional providers, if not in the procedure, at least in the rest of the ritual activities. There was a need to mobilize political support because actually, given the randomized controlled trials, this really hasn't been brought to scale rapidly enough. And there's a real issue around human capacity development and the need for task shifting due to the human resource constraints and scaling up with quality for the population level impact. Now, this looks at the percentage of pregnant women with HIV receiving antiretrovirals for prevention of mother-child transmission. And I want you just to look at the first set of bars, which is sub-Saharan Africa. We've made some progress, but we still only have coverage of about 36%, which is somewhat disappointing. What were the lessons learned? There were several sessions on PMTCT. First, that shorter duration of antiretroviral therapy during pregnancy is associated with higher transmission rates. That key programmatic challenges include advanced gestational age at treatment initiation and loss to follow-up. That early infant diagnosis is critical, and as I showed you before, that most of the deaths were in that 35-month time period. And that CD4 count needs to be integrated so that women who are HIV positive and eligible for HART can be started in HART. And that there is a real need to mentor ANC staff to make sure that there's integration of PMTCT into MCH services. Now, the last section is sometimes called the kitchen sink. It's also known as the cross-cutting and policy. And this is what was discussed in those sessions, harmonization, coordination of national strategies, integration, the global fund, public-private partnerships, human resources, capacity building, task shifting, workplace, strategic information, procurement, PLHIV/AIDS issues and the military. And I'm only going to touch on a few of them. The first is on integration, harmonization, coordination, national strategies, global fund, and public-private partnerships. And these were some of the integration lessons learned, that obviously coordination is essential, that it needs to be predictable, adequate, and consistent funding, that there should be a formal division of labor based on comparison advantage, and that both financial and non-financial resources are required to strengthen national structures and systems, and that underperformance of any one partner negatively impacts the total performance. Now, let's talk a little bit about task shifting, because I think that addresses some of the questions earlier. There were some very interesting examples of task shifting from Namibia, Rwanda, Mozambique, Uganda, and South Africa. And task shifting resulted in time saving for doctors, and that 1 hour of a prescribing nurse saved a doctor 45 minutes. And the overall determination of eligibility to ART nurses is very satisfactory. So let me just show you the data. This is data that's coming out of, I think it is, South Africa. And you can see that by allowing nurses to do the prescribing, they were able to save about 9,300 hours of the physician's time per month. So instead of spending 51% of the physicians spending their time on HIV consultations, it was now 11%. So that freed up the time for the physicians to be involved in other consultations. Now, how did the nurses who were prescribing actually do? And you can see that they did not start anybody on antiretroviral therapy who was not eligible, and they only missed prescribing in 4.2% of the cases. So they performed very well when trained. So in conclusion, task shifting was part of the response to the healthcare workforce crisis, but it was, and it's part of the long-term solution. But more clinical and non-clinical staff need to be added, and it's a zero-sum game. So the cost of shifting responsibilities and to other providers still means that those providers can be overstretched. Supervision and mentoring becomes critical to task shifting, and there was a lot of discussion about different programs for mentoring and support supervision. And there's a need for more pre-service training. But there is a caution here, and that is that task shifting alone cannot solve all the human capacity problems that exist. For strategic information, there were several lessons learned from this conference. The implementer programs are maturing, and that there is now a lot more data available. And there is now a potential for more diverse types of analyses. There's a complexity of monitoring and evaluation systems, and that's becoming a lot more obvious. So strategic information systems now must be seen as multidimensional with just no single or simple solution. So with that, I'd like to thank the rapporteurs, the people of Uganda, and the co-sponsors of the meeting, and thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We didn't know we'd be able to see that, and I know all of you are wondering if you can get it, and OGAC is going to check with IAS because of that the arrangement that they have with IAS. And if IAS is comfortable with that, we'll post it with the webcast of today so everyone can have access to the information. So we have about 30 minutes left. I'm going to turn to Janet and Alicia for a couple questions, and we have some people in the audience that I really want to hear from, so we'll also go quickly to your questions. So let me, Alicia went on our behalf from the Kaiser Family Foundation, and one of the things that I know that you took away from it was all the discussion on prevention. And Caroline mentioned that prevention was a main topic. The challenges and the successes and the long road we still have ahead. So I wonder if you could just share a little bit of that with us.
Sure. Well, as we heard from both Ambassador Dybul and Caroline, that there have been real successes in care, treatment, and support, but we have a long way to go with prevention. And this conference really put all the challenges on the table in a very short period of time, so it was actually a bit daunting when you hear about the daily challenges implementers have with regard to prevention. And the obstacles are numerous. And I think at the conference, there were many more questions asked about prevention than answers provided. There's still basic questions need to be answered in many cases about the basic economic, social, and cultural dimensions of HIV. Also, it was evident that there's many gaps in the data. There was talk about the importance of looking at our last 1,000 cases, and that's much easier said than done. And we need that information to guide programming, to guide the target groups we look at, looking at who's getting infected and how they were infected. And then we need that information to guide programming. But again, that's a lot easier said than done. And Ambassador Deibel at the conference talked about this new era of prevention, and he likened it to chronic disease management. And I think that that does shift the way we look at prevention, because prevention is not one intervention at one point in time. It's a continuum of services over somebody's lifetime or a big part of somebody's lifetime. And there was a really good example of this presented at one of the plenaries, that you take a female, and she starts out as not a sexually active girl. She perhaps becomes a sexually active teenager, young adult. Perhaps she has a baby. Perhaps she doesn't. Perhaps she gets married. Perhaps she doesn't. Perhaps she has multiple concurrent partnerships. Perhaps she's engaging in transactional sex or transgenerational sex. Perhaps she's a victim of gender-based violence. So where do you start, and how many interventions does that person need, and what is the appropriate intervention at all these different points in time? So I think that likening to chronic disease management was actually pretty profound. And we also heard at the conference a lot, and we've all heard this, I think, in the Washington community, that there's no magic bullet for prevention. And I think that there was a lot of talk of combination prevention. I know Ambassador Deibel talks about combination prevention, and rightly so, but there's no magic combination either. And I think within the session of Knowing Your Epidemic, there was a lot of discussion over that there is not one epidemic, it's multiple epidemics, and what combinations work is really dependent on the epidemic in certain environments, which are all very different. And challenges were presented at each level, and in terms of looking at the prevention challenges at the policy level, the leadership level, the social level, the community level, the organization level, and the individual level. And there's a lot of work being done, but it's very complicated, and there's many, many challenges. And I know Caroline has presented some of them today, and many of them are also captured in the webcast. But I think there's a lot of good work being done, but we have a very long way to go. And I have to say that in listening to the implementers over the course of the conference, I was very inspired by the work they're doing, but in many cases they have mountains to climb, and it can be very daunting, but they are doing, there's a lot of good work being done.
Thanks very much. I think it's important to remember that just because of all these challenges around prevention, it's not that prevention doesn't work. It's just, as you said, it's we tend to think of it as a one-off kind of intervention. Janet, really quickly, you've spent most of your energy in the task force really highlighting the importance of understanding gender in the response to HIV. And what were your observations around how that got addressed at the conference?
Thanks, Jen. Let me also just say a quick word of thanks to Kaiser, because I think having these webcasts and the transcripts is enormously helpful, not only to everyone who wasn't there, but also to some of us who were there but couldn't get to all those sessions. So once again, it's a really important tool for those of us in the community to be able to get a sense of what's happening at these meetings. There was a lot of talk about the issues of gender. It was mentioned by Ambassador Deibel, by Peter Piot, by all the main speakers at the opening ceremony. There was very little follow-up, however. There was one panel on gender, which was an interesting session, but didn't go very deep or very far. And some of what Alicia was mentioning in terms of the challenges of prevention, particularly in the social economic realm, and how do you do these linkages with the development agenda? How do you link this up effectively to address the gender drivers of some of the epidemics, if you want to look at it that way, in severely affected countries as well as in more concentrated epidemics? There was not a lot of opportunity at this meeting to really look at the experiences of implementers in that regard. And again, as Ambassador Deibel said, some of that happened in the hallways, in the sidebar conversations, which is always extremely useful. But I think there was some frustration among many of us that there was not the opportunity to really bring to the table the kinds of concerns and experiences that are out there, both in terms of opportunities as well as challenges, and the very key point that Ambassador Deibel raised about how do you scale it up? What information, what evidence are we getting about opportunities to really bring these programs to scale, to address the prevention issues, to address access to care and treatment, and to look at this through the gender lens? I think the other piece that's worth mentioning on this score is in the discussions on integration, and there was particularly a lot on the TB-HIV integration, there was very, very little discussion about the family planning HIV integration or broader reproductive health HIV integration. There was some mention, and it did make it into the discussion in the wrap-up session about prevention, that some of the implementers did describe the importance of bringing family planning and HIV together as a part of effective prevention programming, but there were no sessions devoted to that, and I think there was a lot of interest, given what I understand happened in the Kigali conference last year, in following up on some of these issues and taking it to the next level to really get a sense of what implementers were doing. And I think finally, because I know we want to hear from people in the audience, I think it's just mentioning something that Jim Kim talked about in his presentation about getting beyond traditional M&E into what he called scale-up-ology, to try to figure out how do you do this in a context-specific way. And this certainly applies to the gender issues, but it applies more broadly. What are the lessons we're learning, and what in that context can we replicate? And I think that I hope in next year, as the International Steering Committee makes its decisions, it can look more specifically at how we can highlight some of these issues, both in the panels and in terms of the plenary speakers, to make sure that there are people on those plenary panels who are speaking about the gender dynamics, who can talk about some of the context-specific lessons that we've learned. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Actually, we do have another co-sponsor represented here of the conference, and that's UNAIDS. John Hassel's here, who's the director of the D.C. office from UNAIDS, and I'm going to ask John to let us know UNAIDS' perspective on this meeting, why you're involved in it, and what you see as some of the highlights or challenges or next steps.
Thank you. I just want to quote, I think, what Lyndon Johnson once said about the U.S. Senate, that there are workhorses and show horses in Washington, and the implementers meeting was a conference for the workhorses, and it was great. I know there were many of you who were there, and it was a real intense effort. I think, Janet, I'd like to thank you for coining that new word, scale-up-ology, because I think from the perspective of UNAIDS, what I learned a lot from my colleagues there is there is this real desire for intensifying technical and policy support in the AIDS response at the country level. And I know Mark said reauthorization is off the table for discussion today, but as we look at going from project-specific responses in the countries to a sustained national response, it's real important for the implementers to see how to increase the quality of the data. I heard a lot from my colleagues that there's a, going back to the human resource skills shortage, that there's a real desire to find those kinds of technical experts in monitoring, evaluation, and epidemiology to be in the country and not just flown in from, you know, outside of the continent, but to be there all the time to really help guide the country and help the country run its own programs and intensify in that way. I think any discussion around AIDS is a good news, bad news story. The good news is we've reached 3 million people being put on treatment. There's 6 million more people that need to be on treatment. And the other takeaway, Jen, and I'll stop with this comment, is that there's a real desire for creating champions for prevention. We have them at the international level. I'm pretty confident of that. We have them here in Washington, but we really need them in the countries and in the communities so that we can talk about the tough issues. I think every country, including our own in the United States, we have certain issues that we're really uncomfortable talking about, and AIDS breaks all those rules. So from a UNAIDS perspective, you know, we applaud that this conference really started digging into that, not just throwing out the nice poetry around prevention, but really diving into like what's going to work, and then what do we need to do to build support in the countries and in the region for prevention.
Thanks. one more person that I know I want to hear from, because I wanted to hear a little bit more about the evolution between the meeting last year and this meeting and what changed. And Bill Philbrick from CARE, who came all the way from Atlanta today, was at both. And I thought maybe you could just let us know what you observed, having attended both, and anything you want to add to that point.
I think the previous speakers pretty much covered everything. One of the very obvious changes, changes between the two conferences that I noticed was something that Janet brought up, was in the Kigali conference there was a noticeable attention paid to the role that gender plays in the proliferation of the epidemic. And although that came up in a number of discussions during the Uganda meeting, it wasn't really evident in the titles of the presentations. So, that was just one observation. The other big observation that I think I saw was the increasing role that evidence plays in assessing interventions. It started in Kigali, and there was a greater, I believe, that there was a greater recognition of that the role that we need to be using impact evidence-driven interventions. So therefore, looking more and emphasizing the role that impact studies have and research has, and I got the sense that funders are now, because of that recognition, a little bit more willing to use some of their funds for the research component and doing impact evaluations. So that seemed to be good news. And the last thing that I noticed is in all the discussions, particularly with the community-based organizations, that the role that poverty plays. And we talked a lot about medicalized interventions here, but the role that poverty plays in driving this epidemic, and therefore the role that economic strengthening interventions can have to either ameliorate the epidemic or mitigate the impact on families and people impacted by AIDS.
Okay, thanks very much. So now we have time for other questions. Let's take three questions, and we can't say that anyone up here will be able to answer all of them, but we'll get them out on the table. Yeah, one there, one here. In the back. Okay.
Thank you. Alexis Marosian from AFCO Worldwide. I was wondering if at the meeting there was any discussion about access to medicine and if the scale-up of national programs has improved access to medicines. Thank you.
Okay. There was one up front and one in the back.
Hi, I'm Farley Claymore, head of the Futures Group. I want to talk about the prevention issues that I know this speaks to reauthorization, but it also speaks to what was presented by Caroline. I don't know how many of us saw the article yesterday in the op-ed section by the Uganda co-chair of the Prevention Task Force. And our fundamental model here is partnering with local organizations. And the op-ed article from Uganda suggested that they don't want American organizations or outside organizations telling them how to do prevention. And this is a big issue for all of us. And as we talk about evidence-based approaches, how do we see ourselves dealing with that question?
Hi, I'm Jamila Taylor with the Center for Health and Gender Equity. And my question was also around prevention. And I wonder if any of the groups that were represented at the meeting talked about, you know, the effect of funding restrictions and PEPFAR that are hampering efforts to address prevention in a broad way.
Okay. Does anyone want to take on any of those questions?
Access to medicine.
Access to medicine is a popular one.
Yeah. It's not going to go farther. So actually, access to medicine, I think that the amount of funding that's available through the Global Fund and through PEPFAR and at the country level, we've seen an increase in the access to medications. I think there has been over time an increase in the supply chain management, so that the logistics systems are much improved, so that really the access is all the way down to the peripheral rural levels. The other thing that's improved access to medicine has been the increase in generics, and I know for PEPFAR programs, and I think this we have been able to now increase the amount of FDA fast-track generics to over, I think it's over 60 now. So it's gone from about 15 to 60 in the last, I would say, 2 years. So I think that we have seen an increase in the access. I think the forecasting and the logistic systems, I think I noticed a big improvement in that. I just want to say one thing about the comments around gender, and that is that I was actually on the committee that looked at the abstracts. This is, to a large part, an abstract-driven meeting, and there were very few abstracts. So I would ask, suggest to you all that you work with your constituencies to try to get more abstracts in, because as you can see, there's a lot of abstracts on the treatment and care, and now increasingly on the prevention. But some of the issues around stigma and gender, it was really hard to make up the sessions when there just weren't the same number of abstracts. So I think that I would encourage you to do that. We'd love to see good examples from the countries on scaling up gender and quality programs for reducing stigma. So I would encourage you all to work with your colleagues.
Thanks, Caroline. I think that's certainly something that we should all follow up on in terms of really being proactive and for next year to try to really work with some of the implementers to try to push that agenda forward for the next session. Taking the last question for a minute about the policy issues, there was, as Ambassador Dybul mentioned, there really wasn't a policy tilt to this meeting, at least that I could see, and there was very little opportunity to get into the specific issues that you raise in terms of restrictions in terms of PEPFAR funding and the impact that that could be having on the ground. It was one of many sort of frustrations in that area that we weren't getting into the meat of some of the obstacles as well as the opportunities. And in just one thing on in terms of the partnerships and prevention, I think it would be nice to bring in, I wish we had the video clip of him. Some of you know Canon Gideon from Uganda, who was the first publicly positive priest in Uganda. And he's a very eloquent speaker. Many of you have had the opportunity to hear him either there or in Washington or elsewhere. And I think responding in part to the way President Museveni opened the meeting, Canon Gideon made two comments that I think are worth quoting. He said, some of the implementers are using AIDS to control people. Some are using people to control AIDS. And he went on to say, and this was really in response, I think, to President Museveni, that we are trying to answer the wrong question. We should be asking, is the way you are living your life safe, not is the way you're living your life right? And I think it was interesting because this was also on the heels of the arrest of the activists in the conference, and that obviously was a big issue that highlighted a lot of the concerns that people had about looking at gender in the broadest way and targeting services for communities who are at risk and who are needing prevention, care, and treatment services. But it also highlighted, I think, some of the schisms in Uganda itself about who are the partners, who is sort of dictating what the messages are, and how is that actually being implemented in Uganda itself, which obviously is complicated.
Well, I just wanted to echo Janet's comments, and I'm very happy you brought up those quotes because those quotes have actually been stuck in my head since the conference. But just, you know, really briefly, I think that we are seeing, in terms of prevention, country-level ownership, and there is a strong involvement of people on the ground. And, you know, and also I also echo Janet's comments about kind of this lack of policy tilt, so it's a little bit difficult to comment on that. But, you know, I was seeing, as attending most of the prevention sessions, I was seeing the abstracts being presented by local staff, by them developing, in fact, in South Africa, there was a study initiated of multiple concurrent partnerships across 9 countries in Southern Africa, and that was done by African organizations. And so they're going to take that study, and actually they've developed, the Soul City Institute in South Africa has developed a comprehensive campaign that will launch in October about multiple concurrent partnerships. And I think we're going to see a lot more work being done on the ground because there are so many complicating factors and issues with multiple concurrent partnerships. And I just use that as an example of that we are seeing a lot more country ownership and a lot more local ownership of prevention and involvement in prevention programs.
Just one very quick thing about multiple concurrent partnerships, because as you heard in the video clips and elsewhere, it was a very big theme in terms of prevention. But what we didn't get to was exactly, you know, the drivers of this kind of behavior and some of the social and economic realities that underpin why women and men engage in these practices. And that's just another area that I think we all need to look at more closely as we're trying to design effective interventions to be addressing that.
In terms of local or national ownership in the session that you were talking about, there was two very interesting presentations, one by Zimbabwe and one by Mozambique, where the governments themselves are putting together national prevention strategies with national behavior change strategies, which I think is a really, especially the Zimbabwe example, was an excellent example of having a strategy that then donors would assist a national strategy, and that the strategy was developed with national stakeholders and became a national program.
I wanted to make one comment and ask one question. The question is for Caroline to talk about Zimbabwe just for a moment, because we variously heard that, you know, the PEPFAR program has been responsible for putting somewhere between 40 and 100,000 people on treatment. There's different numbers batted around, but in any case, it's highly vulnerable, obviously, and there's been, as the crisis has worsened, the erosion of the health infrastructure has become profound and acute. And what's the current thinking around the protection of those who are so vulnerable to disruption or who have already been disrupted in terms of ART treatment? The comment is about this dividing line between implementation versus policy. What I understood early on was Mark Dybul asking that we not redirect the discussion today to what the major points of debate on the reauthorization, which I think is fair enough. But I don't think it's fair to say that just listening and seeing Carolyn's presentation, it didn't look to me as if policy issues were taken off the map at this session. I mean, you had your kitchen sink there, which was meant to try and elevate many of the cross-cutting policy issues that were there. And so it didn't seem to me as if you were narrowing the focus down and excluding this debate around sensitive policy issues. It might, however, be possible or advisable, looking to the future, to have a more systematic approach in your agenda that bites off a handful of the most sensitive and compelling policy issues and brings those forward as a very not the kitchen sink, but puts it at the, whatever the alternative is, the front end, in saying, you know, here are a body of the most sensitive issues in our environment here in Washington. How are these issues being interpreted and acted upon by implementers? Because the implementers all have opinions on these issues. It's not as if they go about their life saying, well, we can't think or act on that. Quite the contrary. So as a design issue, it might be something to consider as you look forward.
And I would actually add the reverse, which is, and one of the reasons we had this session, but I think there's more that could be done, is policymakers grappling with these issues here really need to hear from implementers and really need to be able to capture that experience and those issues. And we all know that how something gets conceived of in policy is often far removed from how you then go about making it happen or not making it happen and what those struggles are. And there's sometimes a gap, not just a gap, but a time lag in making those connections. So I think we should all try to find ways to bring that information. We can do it through webcasts. We can do it through abstracts and rapporteur sessions, but there may be some other options. So why don't we take three more questions, and then we'll close. There's one there, back there, and right here. So raise your hands again so they can see. Okay.
Hi, my name is Zach Kaufman. I work for an adolescent-targeted HIV prevention organization called Grassroots Soccer. And I had a question going back to the impact evaluation point. I was wondering if I believe it was Carolyn had brought up in the PowerPoint, kind of glanced over a little bit, ABC and behavior change programs targeting adolescents, and was wondering if we could talk a little bit about what came out of the conference on that end, and then also specific to the impact evaluations, if there's any best practices or good examples of impact evaluations for programs targeting especially early adolescents, and how do you determine their medium and long-term impact when you won't see behavioral or health outcome impact for maybe 5 or 6 years. Thanks.
Okay. Morning. My name is David Jamieson from Supply Chain Management System. And this is more a comment than a question. I wanted to pick up on the question from the back regarding access to medicines and expand that actually to access to medical supplies in general. I think Caroline is right in saying we've made a lot of progress in the forecasting and availability of ARVs and other products directly associated with ART, where the challenge that we're starting to feel in my program is that people are saying, if you can assure supply of ARVs, why am I always running out of antibiotics or scalpels or other things? And I think that's a challenge that's going to come to us in the nuts and bolts of implementing. It's not glamorous, but as we expand the range of interventions into areas with what I call unexceptionable product requirements. Male circumcision, there's nothing fancy about what you need for male circumcision, but clinics, hospitals are constantly running out of those products, and how we bring the disciplines that we've had, that we've been reasonably successful with in ART, to other areas, and that will include how we get more funding in there and the planning and the capacity within those supply systems to do that. And I, as I say, I haven't really got a question for the panel, but just to say that's a challenge that those of us in implementation I think are going to face over the next couple of years.
Thanks. Okay. One more question.
Hi, I'm Derek from Plan USA. My main question was around youth participation in the implementers' meeting. We all know that youth 15 to 24 are the most vulnerable. As well, they form large proportions of populations in a lot of the countries that we work in Africa particularly. Was there a lot of representation at this meeting? Because if you're looking at prevention, they are the main agents of change. They do a lot of the peer education. They do a lot of the programs, as well as sort of VCT mobilization and a little bit in home-based care. I don't know if you can comment about their participation in this meeting. There was nothing mentioned about youth, and we know that we need to target that group because it's a really critical group.
Thanks. Okay.
All right, I'll start from the back and move forward. First of all, for youth, I, in terms of being attendees at this meeting, there were some local youth there that were facilitating the sessions, but I would say that probably there needed to be more people. There wasn't a lot of representation from youth. I think the representation from youth was better in Rwanda, and it was very interesting what they did in Rwanda. They let the nursing schools and the medical schools participate in this meeting. So I think that's a good practice, and I thank you for raising it. We should raise it for the next meeting. But it is something that even though there were two sessions on programs for youth, and I'm glad the person from grassroots soccer asked about that. They were all on behavior change, and I think probably time isn't sufficient for me to go through it, but I'm happy to share those presentations with you because I think there's one very interesting program that you might want to hear about from Botswana called the Zebra Campaign, using soccer as a way to mobilize counseling and testing. And I'll let my colleagues, if they want to speak about the youth issues.
The only thing that I would add on the youth thing, I didn't go to all the sessions on youth, but I did go to one of them. There was an excellent presentation, for example, by Annabelle from the POP Council about some work she's doing to get to vulnerable adolescent girls in Ethiopia. That was extremely interesting. But one of the problems that some of the programs have encountered that we discussed at that session was the lack of sex disaggregated data and the ability to really target vulnerable girls as a group that is always difficult to get to. And often when we talk about youth, the girls sort of disappear. So that was an issue that they acknowledged. But many of these programs are actually targeted more broadly at youth, and therefore some of the issues that girls face that are different than boys, and girls in that age group are often extremely vulnerable to HIV transmission because of different practices, they often fall off the table.
Can I just add one more thing? There was a really interesting session that was just on lessons learned for successful peer education programs. And there were some excellent presentations from FBO and CBO organizations about how do you look at the impact and evaluate peer education programs. So that would be another session I would recommend you looking at.
Thank you. And we are just about out of time, so I'm going to see if anyone else up here has anything else to add.
So in Zimbabwe, as you know, we don't support the government of Zimbabwe, but we do. We are continuing to support CBOs and FBOs that are working there right now, and we are continuing to look at reaching out beyond just the age for in terms of orphans and vulnerable children. It's now become a very important thing. So we are also supporting just beyond the HIV orphans and vulnerable children, orphan and vulnerable children. One of the big things that we've noticed in our bilateral programs was that the Zimbabwean refugees were not being addressed. So what we did is we started in August a program, last August, a program called the Southern Africa Prevention Initiative, and part of that targets migrants in the Southern African region, and a large part of whom are Zimbabwean, because they're being lost to follow-up and their care especially.
May I just follow up on that? If there is a turnaround in Zimbabwe, sort of a post-Mugabe recovery of some description, would you imagine PEPFAR will be integral to attempting to reconstruct some elementary health access within Zimbabwe? Would you expect that you will be called upon, and that the U.S. government more generally is going to be called upon as part of the reconstruction when you've had, 80% loss of your docs, nurses, lab technicians, with very little hope of getting them back?
I would think that if there is a U.S. government response, and if part of that response is in the health sector, since HIV/AIDS is such a large part of the health sector, I would assume that we would be part of that U.S. government health response.
Okay, we'll wrap it up now, and I just want to say from Kaiser's perspective, we remain committed to doing what we can to bring the information from these meetings to D.C. And vice versa, and we really thank you for coming today. We thank CSIS for co-sponsoring this with us and the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator for taking the time to be on the spot as the representative of the co-sponsors of the meeting and also the entity that I'm sure all of you have lots of other questions for. So thanks to them, and thanks again for coming today, and this will be webcast today's session. Many of the things you heard about will be up on the webcast as well, and the abstracts will all be available by August. So thanks very much. Thank you.